And now it's time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. Brought to you every week here on Free Radio Santa Cruz and other places too. Just want to remind you to have a pencil and paper handy to write down something that you might find interesting, something that you want to do, some phone number you want to phone to make your voice heard, perhaps an email you want to send or a web page you want to visit or maybe a place you want to go. Write it down. Here we go. Starting with announcements, the 2014 Earth First Organizers Conference is coming up this week, or about a week. I guess it's next weekend. The Everglades Earth First is excited to be hosting the Earth First Organizers Conference and Winter Rendezvous February 19th through the 24th. For those of you who have attended the last Organizers Conference, remember how cold Southern Ohio was? Well, don't fret. The 2014 Organizers Conference will be held in sleet, rain, snow, and perhaps subtropical weather. Anyway, they're saying it's going to be warm and sunny in the swamps on the alligator and gar, cypress and slash pine, commonly known as Florida. Well, panthers, spiders the size of your hand, mosquitoes the size of birds, sawgrass, palmettos, pythons, why it's the one and only Everglades. The Scouts have chosen a location east of Lake Okeechobee. Directions can be found on the website, which is www.EvergladesEarthFirst.net/EFOC2014. That's the webpage. If you have a vehicle or need a ride, please visit the rideshare board. If traveling by car, bus, rail, airplane, foot, bicycle, canoe, sailboat, or hot air balloon, you're probably going to want to go through Lake Worth, which is the home of Everglades Earth First and the Earth First Journal, as many people will be carpooling from there. Airports in West Palm and Fort Lauderdale connect to Lake Worth by public transportation. Look forward to a wide variety of workshops and discussions, including deep ecology, collective liberation, direct action, tree climbing, trans and or women's self-defense, fire starting, digital security, and much more. They are welcoming children this year with a variety of workshops for kids, including plant ID and survival skills. We also have a packing list, which includes what not to bring, and that is your dog, especially your aggressive, unleashed, unvaccinated, aggressive, unleashed, or unvaccinated dog, especially dogs with cameras. Organizers of the conference are not responsible for protecting your dog from the local gator population or python. If you have a service animal, they're welcome, but you might want to contact Everglades Earth First for some hints about how to protect your critter. You can send them email at EvergladesEarthFirst@riseup.net with your questions, love poems, complaints, and whatever. That's EvergladesEarthFirst@riseup.net. For everything else, go to their webpage at www.EvergladesEarthFirst.net/EFOC2014. And once again, the dates are February 19th through the 24th. Get your boots a-walking towards Fort Worth, Florida for the Earth First Organizers Conference and Winter Rendezvous. Here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field. I don't think they should call it an update anymore. It's a down date. It's been a couple of bad days for America's last wild buffalo, they write. On Tuesday, the press was abuzz with news that Yellowstone National Park planned to slaughter as many as 800 buffalo this winter. What the journalists are reporting in the story did not reveal, because Yellowstone's public relations office kept it from them, was that Yellowstone was already actively engaged in capturing and slaughtering those buffalo. Yesterday, February 12th, Buffalo Field Campaign's Gardner Field Patrol was startled to see a livestock trailer leaving the area of Stevens Creek Buffalo Trap loaded with 20 previously trapped wild buffalo. The truck and trailer, bearing Montana plates and likely belonging to the Confederate Salish and Kootenai tribes, was escorted by two Montana Department of Livestock trucks and a USDA Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service truck. This convoy traveled north from Gardner and then headed west on Interstate 90 en route to a slaughterhouse in Roman, Montana, where all 20 buffalo were or are still in the process of being killed and slaughtered. Buffalo Field Campaign quickly contacted Yellowstone spokesman Al Nash, who informed us that 25 buffalo had been captured on Friday, February 7th, and had been confined in the trap for 5 days. The shipping the 20 buffalo to the slaughterhouse, Yellowstone officials turned the remaining 5 buffalo over to the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, who will use them as subjects of an ill-conceived contraception experiment. Today, our patrol reported that an additional 30 buffalo had been trapped by park rangers who baited the Stevens Creek trap with hay to lure the buffalo in and close the steel doors behind them. It's likely that the park plans to slaughter these buffalo as well. Yellowstone and its partner agencies have set an arbitrary limit of 3,000 to 3,500 buffalo on the size of the population they want. This target is based more on politics than sound science. It is meant to limit the range of wild buffalo. It does not reflect the carrying capacity of the buffalo's habitat in and around Yellowstone National Park. The Park Service has even gone so far as to refer to any buffalo above this number as surplus animals, hence its plan to kill so many this winter. The current buffalo population numbers about 4,400. There are 1,300 in the central interior and 3,100 in the northern range. Yellowstone estimated the population at 4,600 last summer, but 100 have since been killed by hunters, and an equal number have likely died due to winter kill and natural causes. The central interior subpopulation also migrates north into the Gardner Basin and has not recovered from the last park-led slaughter in 2008 that killed over half of the central interior buffalo. The government's population target makes no distinction for conserving subpopulations of this very unique buffalo herd. The current slaughter operations have outraged hunters, including parties from the Nez Perce tribe, who have traveled hundreds of miles to exercise their treaty rights, only to find no bison on the landscape. Meanwhile, only a few miles away, Yellowstone National Park has captured buffalo by the dozens, held them for days inside the trap, and shipped them off to slaughter. Please call Yellowstone National Park Superintendent Dan Wenk, W-E-N-K, tomorrow, Friday, and urge him to stop slaughtering America's last wild buffalo. We want to flood Yellowstone switchboards. The number is 307-344-2002. That's 307-344-2002. And the Buffalo Field Campaign still needs volunteers. Invites you to join the front lines. They have room, board, gear, and training, and Yellowstone is spectacular. Please visit their volunteer page on the website to fill out an application. Email our volunteer coordinators or call 406-646-0070. If you have anything you want to donate to the Buffalo Field Campaign, send it to Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. Their phone number again, 406-646-0070, and the webpage where you can find all this information and more, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. The Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And turning to news of the Olympics, Sochi environmentalist has been jailed for painting on a fence, in this story by Sean Walker of The Guardian, as carried on the Earth First Newswire. An environmental activist who investigated abuses in the buildup of the Sochi Olympics was sent to prison for 3 years by a Russian court on Wednesday morning in a case that fellow environmentalists have said is deeply flawed and intended as revenge for his work. As the sports at the Sochi Games continued, a court in Krasnodar, capital of the southern Russian region that includes Sochi, confirmed a December ruling that activist Evgeny Vitishko's 3-year suspended sentence should become real. Vitishko, one of a group of environmentalists who have investigated irregularities in the construction of mansions by top officials in the Sochi area, was given a 3-year suspended sentence for spray painting the fence of what he and other activists said was a lavish residence built illegally on national parkland by the local governor in 2012. However, in December, a court claimed he was a persistent offender of his parole conditions and made the sentence real. I consider myself innocent, and the case against me is completely fabricated, Vitishko told the court by video. His lawyer also presented 7,500 signatures from local people asking the court not to jail him. However, the judge took the decision in just a few minutes. Vatishko is already behind bars after being arrested separately just a few days before the Olympics on a bizarre charge of swearing at a bus stop. Although swearing in public is frequent in Russia, it is technically punishable by administrative arrest for 15 days, though the punishment is almost never enforced. His fellow activists say Vatishko had planned to travel to Sochi and speak with journalists about his case, which led authorities quickly finding a way to keep him behind bars until the 3-year jail term came into effect. "I have been following this since the start, and it was clear all along it had absolutely nothing in common with the law," said Yulia Nabrzanaya, a fellow activist, by telephone from outside the courtroom. "It's a demonstration of force, and if they are happy to do this right in the middle of the Olympics, it is scary to think what they will do when the Olympics are over." President Vladimir Putin said the environmental situation has improved several times over during the preparation for the Games, but activists say that the intensive construction projects over the past few years have been riddled with gross violations. Late last year, a number of high-profile Russian prisoners were freed, including the country's former richest man, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, and two members of the punk collective Pussy Riot. The releases were seen as an attempt to show clemency and quiet criticism of Russia's rights record in the run-up to the Olympics. However, at the same time, activists in the Sochi area are continuing to be rounded up and harassed. The court hearing that initially turned Vatishko's suspended sentence into a real one came in December, just as the amnesty law was coming into force. "The case against Vatishko has been politically motivated from the start," said Yulia Gorbunova, Russian researcher at the Human Rights Watch. "When all the authorities continued to harass him, it became clear they were trying to silence and exact retribution against certain persistent critics of the preparations for the Olympics." Human Rights Watch called on the International Olympic Committee to pressure Russian authorities to release Vatishko. And elephants in Indonesia are attacking humans in this story by Diana Parker of Manga Bay, as carried on the Earth First Newswire. "It was near dawn on January 4th when a critically endangered Sumatran elephant destroyed a small shack near a plantation in Indonesia's Aceh province, killing a local farmer from West Aceh and injuring his 13-year-old son. Yusmani, 59, was trampled to death while his son Reverendi escaped with a broken leg. Less than 1 month later, on February 2nd, another Aceh farmer, Sayahril, was returning home from his plantation near the border of Burian district when he encountered 5 wild elephants on the road. A large male elephant reportedly blocked his path, then began butting Sayahril's motorbike, eventually pushing him off the bike before heading back into the forest with the rest of the herd. Sayahril was taken to a hospital to be treated for his injuries after being rescued by residents of a nearby village. There may be as many as 500 elephants left in Aceh, nearly one-fifth of the total Sumatran elephant population. The province still contains extensive forest cover compared with other areas in Sumatra. However, deforestation and increased human activity in elephant habitats have led to a rise in encounters between elephants and local communities, often with tragic consequences. Last year, 8 elephants died in Aceh, and 1 person was killed and another injured in elephant attacks. This year, 1 elephant has died so far in Aceh, killed by an electric fence in southeast Aceh district on January 21st. Residents removed the animal's tusks before burying the carcass, though the tusks were later confiscated by police who are currently investigating the case. According to Wadi Azmi of the Indonesian Elephant Conservation Forum, these conflicts occur because the government ignores the existence of elephants as part of the ecosystems where human activities take place. Nearly all of Aceh's elephants, nearly 80%, live outside of protected forests and conservation areas, he said, and their habitat is shrinking as forests are open for plantations, road construction, and mining. This is aggravated by an increase in illegal activities around forest areas and weak law enforcement, Wadi told Manga Bay, Indonesia. Meanwhile, a new government regulation is set to open the door for development in large swaths of protected forests in the province, further reducing the habitats of elephants and other endangered species in Aceh, including rhinos, tigers, and orangutans. On December 27th, Aceh's local legislative body passed a controversial piece of legislation that would rezone sections of protected forest in Aceh for mining, plantation development, and other uses. The Aceh Regional Spatial Plan, which is currently awaiting approval by the central government, would rezone approximately 146,000 hectares, almost 400,000 acres of forest, including nearly 80,000 hectares of protected forest and other conservation areas that would be zoned for development as an aerial Penganan Lane, or land designated for other uses falling outside the forest estate. If the spatial plan is approved, the potential loss of lowland forests will likely lead to even more widespread conflict between elephants and local communities, and may threaten the very existence of Sumatran elephants in Aceh province. Over the next 5 years, if the plan is approved, the conflicts will escalate dramatically, Ian Singleton, conservation director of the Sumatran Orangutan Conservation Program, told Mangabe Indonesia on February 12th. Then, within 5 years, the elephants will be gone. I'm quite confident of that. However, by talking to experts who understand the elephant ranges, then identifying, reclaiming, and reforesting the land that they frequently travel, conflicts could be reduced, Singleton said. This would protect communities from potentially deadly encounters and reduce crop destruction and other property damage, which would in turn keep frustrated communities from resorting to poaching. However, if current development patterns continue, the problem will likely continue to get worse. In Bulo Village, where Yusmani was killed and his son was injured earlier this year, community members said the plantation where the attack took place used to be covered by forest and was part of a track used by elephants. But after a coal mine opened in the area, the forest was cleared. Now it's been deforested, Ibnu, a Bulo resident, said, as quoted by the Jakarta Globe on January 5th, the elephant's trail has become a track for cars and trucks carrying coal from the mine. And a lawsuit has been filed to save San Diego's vanishing burrowing owls and wetlands. Following outrage within the environmental community last year over a report documenting the destruction and poisoning of burrowing owl homes at Brownfield Municipal Airport near San Diego, the Center for Biological Diversity and allies have filed a legal challenge to a city development proposal that would destroy sensitive wetland and burrowing owl habitat at the site. The development of Brownfield would evict the largest known burrowing owl colony in San Diego from its nests. These unique creatures have been all but eliminated from the area by urban development, as have the vernal pools, which also would be sacrificed. The county has lost about 98% of its vernal pools, home to rare species such as the San Diego fairy shrimp. San Diego rejected simple steps to protect sensitive wildlife at Brownfield from recklessly being paved over, said Jonathan Evans, a center attorney. Until San Diego follows its own policies to protect our rare and vanishing wildlife and fixes the broken parts of its conservation program, we'll be forced to take them to court. And you can find out more information at www.biologicaldiversity.org. And a scientific panel has faulted a U.S. plan to lift nationwide wolf protections in this story reported by Laura Zuckerman, edited by Steve Gorman and Lisa Schumacher, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. The Obama administration used flawed research in devising a plan to strip gray wolves across the continental United States of Endangered Species Act protections and discounted evidence that failed to support it, a scientific panel said in a report released last Friday. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service said last June that wolves in the lower 48 states no longer faced extinction after decades of recovery efforts and proposed removing them from the U.S. threatened and endangered species lists. Distinct wolf populations in the Northern Rockies and Western Great Lakes were already delisted in recent years as their numbers rebounded in those regions. The administration's latest plan renewed a debate between supporters and opponents of wolves, which were hunted, trapped, and poisoned to near extinction in the continental United States before coming under federal safeguards in the 1970s. Ranchers and hunters blame wolves for preying on their livestock and big game. Conservationists say the wolf, an apex predator, has helped restore ecosystems strained by an overabundance of wildlife such as elk and deer. The Wildlife Service claimed in August, in August placed its nationwide wolf delisting proposal on hold after outcries by critics who claimed the government's process was slanted toward removing protections. The agency last year asked the National Center for Ecological Analysis and Synthesis at the University of California at Santa Barbara to appoint a panel of independent scientists to review the delisting plan. The Fish and Wildlife Service on Friday released the panel's report, which said the agency failed to use the best available science as required to conclude nationwide delisting is warranted. The government also relied on a single publication by the Wildlife Service that had been refuted by leading wolf experts and geneticists and rejected data that did not support the plan, according to the report. Quote, information contrary to the proposed delisting is discounted, whereas that which supports the plan were accepted uncritically, unquote, wrote panelist Robert Wayne, a wolf geneticist at UCLA. The Wildlife Service on Monday will reopen the proposal for public comment for 45 days in light of the findings, which the agency is reviewing, said Seth Willey, regional recovery coordinator in Denver. A final decision is expected this year. Wiley and said several wolf packs are known to exist in Oregon and Washington State, and wolves have wandered from the northern Rockies into such states as Colorado, not to mention California. The proposal in question would leave federal protections in place for the Mexican wolf, a subspecies in Arizona and New Mexico estimated to number in the 80s. While wolves once roamed freely across nearly every corner of the continental United States, Wiley said the Endangered Species Act does not require reestablishing a species to its full historic range in order to prevent extinction. The comeback of wolves, which now number in the thousands in the lower 48 states, is an amazing success tied to the nation's landmark conservation law, he said. Conservation groups last Friday hailed the panel's findings, which are sure to be used to challenge the delisting in court. If the delisting happens, we've known all along there was a political motivation behind the delisting proposal, and the panel's review underlined that, said Bethany Cotton, Wildlife Program Director for Wild Earth Guardians. And Shell has been forced to cancel its 2014 Arctic drilling program in this story by Faith Gemmel of Platform London, as found in the Earth First Newswire. The Court of Appeals in the Ninth Circuit Court has ruled the U.S. government violated the law when it sold offshore oil and gas leases in the Chukchi Sea off the coast of Alaska. The decision stems from a lawsuit filed by a coalition of Alaska Native and conservation groups represented by Earth Justice. Resisting Environmental Destruction on Indigenous Lands, or Red Oil, joined this lawsuit because we strongly uphold and promote the subsistence right of Alaskan natives, and offshore development poses a very real threat to those rights in relation to the Chukchi Sea and Inupiat subsistence, and that is unacceptable. Indigenous peoples have always viewed human rights and a healthy environment as fundamentally linked. The careful management and protection of the Arctic environment is a requirement for the enjoyment of Alaskan Native human rights, particularly as they relate to the subsistence or traditional economy. Indigenous peoples of Alaska have long fought for recognition of subsistence rights as a basic, inherent, and fundamental human right. The Inupiat of the North Slope of Alaska continue to live the ancestral subsistence way of life, which is totally dependent on a healthy ocean ecosystem. This right is recognized and affirmed in the International Covenants on Human Rights. Article 1 of both the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights read in part, "In no case may a people be deprived of its own means of subsistence." The proposed offshore drilling of the Chukchi Sea puts subsistence rights in multinational companies at odds. Though the subsistence rights of the Inupiat was not a foundation of the ruling, it puts the impacts of those subsistence rights on the table again, because the impacts to the natural habitat and ecosystem of subsistence resources needs to be analyzed once again. And you cannot separate environmental impacts from subsistence impacts, for they are the same. In this recent win, the court ruled that the Department of Interior failed to adequately analyze the potential dramatic environmental effects of the sale before offering the leases. It determined that the agency had analyzed, quote, only the best-case scenario for environmental harm, assuming oil development, unquote, and that, quote, this analysis skews the data toward fewer environmental impacts and thus impedes a full and fair discussion of the potential impacts of the project, unquote. The agency will have to revise or supplement its analysis for the lease sale once again, and must reconsider its lease sale decision. We believe that the lease sale should be canceled. That would be the best decision that the U.S. government can make on this case for several important reasons. First is the relationship that the Inupiat have with the Chukchi Sea and the resources it provides the communities for their food security. May Hank, Inupiat grandmother from the community of Point Hope, was happy with the decision. Quote, with this court ruling, it has given me a sense of contentment for now that we have prevented another intent to drill in nature's abundance of our food resources. The whaling season coming in a few months, we will worry not. My heart sings with joy for this ruling. We know there is justice, unquote. The Chukchi Sea is home to several important Arctic species, such as polar bears, walrus, beluga whales, bowhead whales, and seals. Therefore, the Chukchi Sea of the Arctic Ocean is critical to Inupiat subsistence lifestyle. These vital subsistence resources that are intrinsic to the livelihood of the Inupiat within the Arctic Oceans are at risk from pollution, noise disturbances, and spills. A major oil spill in the Arctic Ocean would be impossible to clean up and could have devastating consequences for the region's ecosystem and communities. Another factor to take into consideration is that Shell has proven it has no capacity to drill in this region. In 2012, the company suffered severe setbacks and mishaps, included running one of its rigs aground, almost running another of its rigs aground, incurring pollution and safety violations exceeding $1 million, with investigations still ongoing. This should all be taken into consideration since the company itself suspended its program for 2013, acknowledging that it was not equipped to drill in this harsh Arctic region. And mysterious bald eagle deaths are under scrutiny in Utah. Reporting by Laura Zuckerman, editing by Steve Gorman and Kenneth Berry of World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. A number of unexplained bald eagle deaths in Utah when hundreds of the government-protected birds have migrated to wintering grounds in the central Rocky Mountains has wildlife officials worried. Officials said that at least four bald eagles have died and another is close to death. Wildlife specialists said the deaths began December 1st and point to either an outbreak of disease or exposure to some unknown toxin among the raptors in Utah. The ailing eagles, which have been reported everywhere from front yards to riverbanks, have died within days of being grounded by such symptoms as leg paralysis and tremors. We have no idea what this is or isn't, so we can't rule anything out at this point, but we're taking it very seriously, said Leslie McFarlane, Utah Wildlife Disease Coordinator. McFarlane said the state has never before tracked the deaths of so many bald eagles in rapid succession over a wide geographic area, and she is not aware of a similar event elsewhere. The bald eagle, the U.S. national symbol, was removed from the federal and threatened and endangered species list in 2007 after their numbers came back from near extinction. A key culprit in the plummeting eagle populations in the 20th century was the pesticide DDT, which was banned back in 1972. Eagles are still safeguarded by two federal laws, which make it illegal to kill or injure them without a special permit. Bird carcasses found in Utah have been sent to a U.S. lab for testing, with results expected in coming weeks. Four of the affected eagles, one found over the weekend was still clinging to life, were tended to at the Wildlife Rehabilitation Center of Northern Utah in Ogden. We haven't seen anything like this before, with so many coming in from different areas at the same symptoms and in such a short time span, said Daylin Marthaler, the center's executive director. Marthaler said the facility, which treats up to 400 eagles and other raptors each year, fears death is imminent for the adult male eagle still in its care. Words can't describe what it feels to see them struggling and to know that there's nothing that can be done until we know more about what's causing this, she said. And that's all the time we have for news this week on the Earth First Update. The Earth First Update is presented each week here at 9 o'clock on Thursday night at Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM. You can listen to a rebroadcast tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock right here on Free Radio. Or you can tune in to KRFP, Radio Free Moscow, Idaho, Monday nights at 9:30 on their new high-power frequency of 90.3 FM. You can also download a podcast at radioforall.net. We want to thank you for listening. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Tune in next Thursday evening for another edition of the Earth First Update.